that's Johnny and the Hurricanes, and a little Down Yonder. I don't know if y'all remember Johnny and the Hurricanes. This is WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, United States of America. And this is a radio program called QSO Live, because we're live. For no other good reason. I want to say hello to my co-host here, David.
And a good evening to you there, sir.
Why don't you give the call sign there?
I am David. I'm KG4WXW.
And, of course, you know, my call sign's WB8PUM. And with us tonight, we have a very, very special guest, a fellow by the name of Ted Turner, K5TED. Hello, Ted. Well, okay, I guess, you know, we're always pushing the wrong buttons. Our guest is Ted Turner, K5TED. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Ted.
You know what? We've got an Axia console here, and I failed to press the feed button that sends you the signal, so you were unaware I was even talking to you.
I was in the dark. I didn't know what was going on.
Well, tell me, sir. You've got the call sign K5TED. That's really, really cool. It'll be a little confusing tonight because I'm Ted, and of course you are Ted.
You know what? But two Teds on the radio at the same time cannot be a bad thing.
Well, you don't know
who you are.
Depends on who the Ted is. On this end here, now I don't know. Well, okay. We kind of met up, I guess I want to say, and I thought you would be a real, real interesting guest because of the fact that not only do you have an interest in amateur radio, but you are also a radio engineer. And I don't know how long you've been doing that, but why don't you kind of fill us in?
Okay, so I'm not presently a radio engineer, but I did do that for 15 years. My radio career started in 1985. And the backstory on that is that I had always been a radio fanatic. I think my earliest recollections of enjoying radio were around second grade, when I was gifted an old night shortwave receiver by the TV repairman across the street from where we lived. And so I got really interested in just shortwave listening and all those weird squeaks and warbles and squeals and things that you could pick up, and plus all of the really interesting shortwave radio broadcasts that were on the air back in, you know, circa 1967, 68. And so from there, I guess it just kind of evolved. Over the years, I ran into, people using taxi radios, you know, back to the radio or TV repairman across the street. He was also a ham operator. And at one point, I got a crystal radio set. For I think it was my birthday. It was either birthday or Christmas, and I got a crystal radio set, one of those Remco, those blue plastic Remco sets. Maybe you remember those.
Oh yeah,
that was great. And I set it up. I had a second floor bedroom, and so I had plenty of altitude from which to launch my. If you remember, it came supplied with a long wire antenna of some sort of aluminum wire of questionable provenance, and. That's what I strung up, and I immediately started hearing something other than radio broadcasts, and it was the guy across the street on his ham radio, so I didn't even know he was a ham. And so he kind of showed me ham radio, but I really wasn't sort of interested in it as much at that age. I really was more interested in listening to the radio. But on years later, after a few clandestine FM broadcasting stations in the sixth grade, 9-volt battery powered stuff, mind you. I got into audio and audio recording. You know how it was back in the late 70s. You know, if you had reel to reels, you were cool. So if you had a home stereo and you had a reel to reel, you were really cool. And of course, we had reel to reels when I was in college, and all my roommates all kind of gathered our respective stereo systems together. We had the biggest reel to reel setup that you could imagine there, and so we were doing all kinds of crazy audio stuff. So I was interested in audio and dubbing and recording and things, and we were all kind of pseudo hobby musicians. So there was that audio part. Well, it all came together when, at one point, a college friend of mine rescued me from the early 1980s oil field. I decided that I wanted to go to be a roughneck because roughnecks made a lot of money back then. And at one point, the oil field started kind of going down a little bit. It was kind of dipping a little bit, Ted. So my buddy said, you know, hey, why don't you, you know, you've always been kind of a nut about audio recording and with your radio stuff and your shortwave. Why don't you come try to get a job at the local radio station where he worked as an engineer. And they were taking it was an AM/FM combo, a little AM/FM combo up in northwestern Oklahoma. They were taking a Class C FM from automated. It was on a Harris 9000. You remember the Harris 9000 automation system? It was a computer-controlled monstrosity that controlled four Otari reel-to-reels and an Instacart machine and a big carousel cart player, and it did everything all by itself.
What was that? Was it a computer or more like a brain thing?
It was the very early, not the earliest ones of the automation. If you remember, were the pin programming ones. You know, Sparta had a pin programming where you put these metal pins into these holes to program certain events to happen at certain times in this this grid. This was actually a computer, and it actually executed some commands and executed a play or, you know, a play sequence with all the reel-to-reels and the Instacart and the carousel and all that. Well, they wanted to take that away from that. It was on, the music service that they were on was the something old gold system. I'll remember it in a minute. But anyway, it was a music service that you got reels every couple of weeks, updates with recurrence and currents and recurrence and oldies and things like that, and they updated it. They wanted to take it away from that and make it a live station just like the AM station, which was a farm station. Love farm stations. This is farm information, ag reports, country music, you know, the whole shot, all live. They wanted to make the FM station a local live with news, full-service adult contemporary station. So they needed basically some lackeys to fill in on the weekends, which that's where I kind of fit in. I had no idea what I was doing. But so my buddy got me a job there, and I started out on weekends. And within about 2 months, they offered me a full-time job because I was so fascinated with everything that I played with everything. Cart machines, by the way, if you were someone who fooled around with consumer audio, even I think pro audio recording equipment and so on and so forth, and you know, back then when you walked into a production room that had cart machines and, you know, like a B77 Revox sitting there, you were like, what is this? What am I supposed to do with this? And so I had to learn that stuff, and now I did, and I got a full-time job there. I started out
the cart machines we used in broadcast, actually those were the same exact carts that were used on the consumer side back when they were making four-track audio tapes. I didn't know if you were aware of that or not.
Yes, they were. Yeah, the old four-track, you know, before eight tracks, right? They were Lear. I think they were Lear, weren't they?
I don't know. There was different
four track.
There was different manufacturers of them, but I just remember they were the same. Of course, now when they came out with the A track had its own pinch roller inside of it.
Right, which we didn't have.
No,
and that's a whole other thing in itself, because as the engineer, as the responsible engineer, you had to occasionally go in and measure the pinch roller tension on the cart machine to make sure that it wasn't slipping, it wasn't causing. You know, really, what happened was the morning guy or the afternoon guy or the farm show guy would come in and say, "Hey, my tapes are dragging. What's going on here?" And you would go in there and you would probably find a worn out pinch roller.
What I liked,
you had to change that out.
What I liked is when the things would go deaf to the Q-tones.
So oh, yeah.
You'd be on the air, you'd mash a button, the commercial would play, then the jingle, and you go back into music, and all of a sudden, you know, this voice would come out of nowhere. Well, when you're in the mood for it, it was one of those carts that didn't stop, you know?
Exactly. It just rolls right on through.
Yeah.
So you'll love this. One of the cart machines that we had, so remember, we're taking this FM station from being fully automated on this Harris 9000 automation system, and we're taking this down to being live, but we still want to use the Harris automation equipment because we have it there. We have four big Otari reel-to-reels. We have our entire music format on reel-to-reel. We have all our commercials on the Instacart. We have some on the carousel machine. And so what we did was we basically went in and put the thing on manual, and the station engineer at the time, who was, I won't call him an itinerant radio engineer, but he was the guy that showed me a lot. He really educated me on some just basic principles of how things work in the radio station, Harry Benson, and I'll never forget that guy. But he built a push button. And this push button was the thing that when you pushed it once, the system halted. When you pushed it again, the system resumed. And so they would still load the playlist in, and when it was time for us to talk, we would push the button, and the system would halt. The currently playing event would play out, and it would wait for another button push. Well, you can imagine the hilarity that would ensue if you accidentally pushed the button twice and started talking, because then basically the cart roll-through syndrome would happen, because you would be talking and then the next song would start playing because you pushed the button twice. So we had to learn how not to push the button twice. And that's how we ran it for a long time, until we came up with a more elaborate system of a couple of buttons to stop, start, pause, that kind of thing with the automation system. But that was good stuff. And, you know, that's how we ran that station for a long time, full service news. Music, news. We had a great morning show. I have a really soft spot for hometown radio. And I don't know about you, Ted, but hometown radio to me is something really special, because you get to provide all the local community news and events. It doesn't matter how big the market is. You know, it can be something where you've got, you know, 20,000, 30,000, maybe 40,000 people around the county or a couple of counties adjacent that might be listening to you for the local quote unquote news. But you get to talk about local things. You talk about the local weather, and people know you. And you go out and you do remotes. You know, just like any radio station, you do remotes, but you know, in this case, you're doing a remote down at, you know, Bob's Radio Shack, right? Back when you could have like a Radio Shack and a Maytag store. You know, it's a Bob's Radio Shack and satellite TV, Bob's Radio Shack and used cars. I mean, but you would go there and you would do a remote, and people would come around and they know you, they know your name. You probably know a lot of them personally because it's a very small community. And you get to do the local sports. And I understand one of your sons does college sports.
Yes.
College sports is just sports in general. High school sports, you know, we did the whole thing, the high school football, the high school basketball. We did high school, when they picked up soccer, we did high school soccer. That is boring, but we did it. And, you know, sports, local sports is something else. And at the next station that I worked at, we had a small community college, University of Science and Arts of Oklahoma, the USAO Drovers, Lady Drovers, men's and ladies basketball. They had basketball teams. That was good stuff. That was very educational. We got to get into all kinds of remote broadcasts, you know, just on a regular basis, weekly, from the local venue or from you know, some faraway place, which was always interesting with POTS lines, as you well know. And, you know, local radio is, it's a really cool thing. And
I can remember early on, though, having to go do a remote, and the radio station actually had a trailer, a big trailer, you know, with a call sign all over. But I remember I don't remember what the arrangement was, but when we got out there, there was none. So I had to run a wire all the way over to a phone booth, and I dropped a coin in the phone booth and called back to the radio station. And then I took the receiver, disconnected the receiver at that point. I don't remember how I did that. I think all I had to do was unscrew the mouthpiece to take the carbon mic out. Back then, they weren't like glued together, you know, and I left it off the hook, and then I put an out of order sign on on the payphone, and that was our remote link. And oddly enough, the audio was not all that bad. A whole lot better than what you get today, you know, from a payphone or something like that. But I can also remember back during that time, we would install what was known as a burglar alarm circuit. I don't know if they still have that now. I guess it's just a dry pair. I don't know, but it didn't seem to have any kind of equalization on it. It had no filtering on it, so it was just as flat as a pancake. It passed high fidelity, you know. So the times have changed since then.
Yes, they have. Well, so I have to digress just a little bit. So the very first radio station I worked at, like I say, was the one that we, you know, that I started working there, and we took it to live, and it was great, and met a lot of great radio people there. Local radio people are something else. And we had some characters there. There was one guy by the name of and you know what I'm talking about. He went by the name of Keith Michaels. Michaels is probably one of the most popular air names ever. There are so many Michaels on the air across the country that I don't know if they're all related or maybe just in spirit. But he taught me oldies. And that's one thing that I really enjoy about your shows, Ted, is you play all my songs. And I didn't really think that at the time that I was such an oldies fanatic until I started listening to Keith's oldies show. And he was playing all the stuff that I grew up listening to that I actually forgot about. You know, all the songs that you forget, all the Jay and the American stuff and the Tommy James and the Shondells and all that stuff. It's like, wow, I remember that when I was in, you know, first, second, third grade, you know, and just completely forgot about it. But there it came back. And so he taught me oldies. And at one point he left. I took over the oldies show. So I became the oldies guy. And I was doing this oldies show. And, man, the calls would come in from, you know, all over southwestern Oklahoma. Everywhere from, you know, the Dairy Queen to the state penitentiary down in, McAllister. They actually let the inmates call in to make requests. It's something else. But that was fun. That was interesting. And that was one of my most favorite things about being on the air. Which, by the way, I have to say that I was kind of split in radio between the love of the equipment or the methodology by which I would be able to project my voice out into the ether so that other people could hear me and actually being behind the mic. I don't know if that makes sense, but I was always torn between the two.
Well, it's like when you're in radio engineering, you build everything. You know, you build the radio station. You work on the radio station. You work on the transmitters. And when they go down, you've got to figure out what's wrong with them. You know, and you do all these things, and then you come back inside the building and sit down at the console behind the microphone and you play the records. You know, it's like, I don't know. That's been one of my problems. My problem is I wear too many hats. And I don't mind that at all, but I find that it intimidates other people. If you have the capability of being on the air and you also are an engineer and you understand directional AMs and you understand transmitters that are 50,000 watts and above, and you understand FM, and you understand AM, and you can do all those things. Plus, you know, you can actually sit down and do, like, well, here in Nashville, I did an oldie show on our, at that time, our big oldie station, 96.3, and I scored some pretty heavy numbers in the ratings, you know. And that was only because I had really, really super good coach, somebody that that kind of worked with me, because when they offered me the job, I said, I'm too old for this. I can't do this, you know. And my friend said, oh, no, you need to do this, you know. So, no, I think that when you love the radio business and you're multitasking and you happen to learn engineering and you learn programming and on the air and you understand what music rotations are and you understand how to write commercial copy that's compelling, you know, that will cause the products to move off the shelf. I think the reaction today, and I hate to say this, and I don't want to sound egotistical, it scares people. You know, don't you find, though, that today in the broadcasting business that the variety of people that are in it are different than the people that you and I grew up with? They don't seem to have that passion or that, you know, it's like if they do on the air work, they could care less how the transmitter works, you know, and most engineering people could care less what it's like to be inside of a studio and do a radio show. I mean, that's what I see. It's like you can't get the two of them together. It's two different things, apples and oranges.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, I have to go back to my old engineering mentor, Harry Benson. You know, he was, think of it, that was his name. That was his air name, Harry Benson. That's a great air name. I don't care who you are. And he had this very laid back, kind of a gruff demeanor, and he would not only make the station run, but he had a little show, you know. And so that's where I learned. You know, you can be the guy that knows how to wire the mic in, and I'm not talking about plugging it in. I'm talking about running, you know, Belden balanced cable from the microphone back into the Audigram console and coming up through the bottom and getting it on the right terminals and setting the levels right. You know, there's a lot to it. And you said, not just plugging something in.
You said Audigram?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had, at my first station, we had, this is great stuff. The FM station that we took from automated to live had an Audigram. Was it a 1010? But then in the AM station, we had the Rockwell Collins version of that same console.
Oh, yeah.
Also a 10-channel with the rotary pot.
With a Davin, those Davin wire-wound pots that have the little notches instead of a resistor. Yeah. Well, you know, Ernie Ankley is the fellow that was the brains behind Audigram. And my favorite consoles of all time is the AC-8 and the IC-10 because they had the transformers in them. If you pull those transformers out and put the solid-state modules in, they don't sound right. They sound brittle. But those old transformers and those things, there was something just really magical about the sound of those. Now, for Christmas, I got, what was it, a pacemaker.
Yes, yeah, the pacemaker.
David found an Audigram pacemaker that was as wide as a 1956 Buick, okay? I mean, this thing is huge. And how many channels did that thing have on it?
That one has the 16.
So it's big, you
yeah.
know.
It huge.
But the only disadvantage was it had sliders, not Davin pots, you know. So I was kind of saying, boy, I love Audigram, but gosh, it would be nice if this had the rotary pots. Well, anyways, we put it in, and just about the time I got good and used to it, they come along and said, well, guess what we're going to do? And what? We're going to replace this with an Axia radius. Well, okay, I love the Axia stuff, and I like the live wire, you know, all the audio over IP, and it's wonderful. You get a couple of nodes in one of these consoles, and my God, you can do anything you want to do. And then you put drivers in your machines. You pull the sound cards out and put the Axia drivers in. Then the magic really begins, you know. But when they installed it, I love the console. That's what I'm looking at right now. But sitting beside the Autogram pacemaker, it looks like a mic mixer, okay? I'm sorry, it just does. So I don't know. Have you ever done any work with any of the Axia stuff?
I have not. You know, that's so, I have to say I have not been in front of a console since 2000. I got out of radio in 2000, did my little 15-year stint, and I kind of like you, I was wearing so many hats and I had so little time to do anything that I kind of got really disenchanted with the whole thing. And but I got a good offer and went on to still stay with within the radio business, but in a different sort of function. But I got to say, I want to go back to the pots. You know, there's an art to spinning a rotary pot up after you push the start button. There's definitely a very learned, a very practiced sort of move that one does with that. It's not simply pushing a button and, you know, twisting the knob up. There's a thing you do with your finger on the edge of the knob, you know, makes it hot up at a certain rate and fade in at a certain rate and sound a certain way. You know what I'm talking about?
I guess I'm not aware of that. I've worked my share of wire wound pots, and I've also had my share of the steppers, you know, which I prefer the steppers. But you're right. If you have a source on and you don't turn it up just right, you get that. You can actually.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It has to be quick. It has to be fast. And it has to be deliberate. And you have to know where to stop it at. And that was kind of the fun thing. So we had the Autogram consoles. As a matter of fact, the next station that I was at, the first station, I kind of graduated from there. The GM left that station, and he went to manage a station in a somewhat larger market that wasn't far away. And then eventually he pulled me over there. So I came over there as a program director. So I want you to be the program director, but I also want you to be an engineer. This is where we get into the wearing of the many hats, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so I jumped at that opportunity. I said, you know, it gets me closer to a larger market. At the time, I still kind of had these notions that, I might want to continue this and kind of move up through the ladder. And so I'm going to do this. That'll get me, you know, within 35 miles of a larger market. So I did it. And that radio station was another combo AM FM. We had a 1 kilowatt daytime, 250 nighttime directional, two tower directional station. That was my first hands-on experience where I was in charge of the directional array. Before, we had a directional array, but my buddy was the engineer, so he was in charge of that. I didn't touch that. So at the next station, I was in charge of it, and we had a Gates BC1H, I believe it was, AM transmitter, and a CCA 3000D FM transmitter. And that had a little four element that was ISO coupled to the side of one of the AM towers. I'm sure you've seen that arrangement before. That's always interesting to work on. And so that was kind of a crazy deal. I came into there, and this station, Ted, was running all Sparta consoles.
Oh boy! Now,
if you remember the Sparta desk, it was a five channel little miniature console. I think it was probably, I don't know, I'm just holding my hands apart, I'm going to say like 18 inches wide.
Yeah, those little carbon pots on the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you turned it down into Q, it made a nasty click.
Yeah, and it was so. They had an FM studio and an AM studio, and they both had the same desk. So back then, Sparta sold this. It was the Sparta desk. So you got the five-channel console, and then you got the two turntables and a microphone. Not to steal from Beck, but that's what it was. And it literally was two turntables and a microphone, and then I think it was an ITC cart machine, a three-slot the little tower one that had the single spindle in it. And so that was the station when I got there. And I was thinking to myself, this looks really puny compared to what I just came from with the autogram and the Rockwell Collins. But I think, you know, and the first order of the day was, please improve things. Make things sound better, because they had a lot of problems with crackly pots and crackly switches and misfiring carts and all kinds of things. So that was what I spent about the first year doing, was trying to get all that smoothed out. Eventually, I got to buy an autogram console to put in my FM studio. And
those little Spartas were the selector switches, instead of going from program to audition, they went to channel 4A to channel 4B input. So yes, you were switching inputs on that little switch at the top, you know. And little tiny VU meter in the center. I mean, they were just... But you know what? They served their purpose. They worked.
Oh, they did.
They were. Now, I had one of those in a van, and it was out in the west side of Detroit at a station. The call sign was WSDS. This van was a little blue van, had a crank-up tower. The tower folded over the top of the van when you were going down the road, and as it was folded over was this amber flashing light, dual Yagi Marty antennas. And then, of course, it would tilt up vertical, and then you would crank it up three sections. There were bullhorn speakers at the top. And then inside the little van was a pretty powerful air conditioner. There was a generator mounted in the side in case you needed it. Of course, there was a heater in there. But then there was the Sparta board. There was two cart machines. They were the old Harris or Gates Criterions. And two turntables, and of course your microphone. And boy, I don't know. I spent two summers in that thing. I really got sick of remotes, you know. But it was. I think back on it now, and I thought, Lord, what fun that was, you know, compared to what's going on in radio today. Again, imagine pulling right up in this van, and you're playing the records, the commercials, everything, you know. And people are coming by, they're looking through the windows, and it's amazing to see. You're doing a live radio broadcast. You know, today, these radio stations, they show up with cell phones. We're going to do a remote, you know, with a cell phone. So, anyhow, but that was incredible. You know, but a Sparta was about the only thing you could fit in there. I mean, you just couldn't, because it was so small.
And, yeah, well, there weren't any compact mixers yet. At the time, you know, in the late 70s when the Sparta was the thing, you know, it wasn't long after that, you know, you could get a small sort of console, but you know, radio stations, small market radio stations, did not really splurge out on new equipment all the time, as you probably know. The budget was pretty tight on the equipment.
Well, let me ask you a question. No, I don't want to jump the gun too fast, but I do want to ask. So, with all this going on, how did you get into amateur radio? What was the first time you ever saw an amateur rig in operation? Now, you said it was there was a fella across the street that you were hearing on your crystal radio, but I guess I'll rephrase that and say, when was the first time you saw amateur radio demonstrated and you said, oh boy, I'm gonna have to get into this?
Okay, so that's a great question, because yes, and I'll go back to the guy across the street. I think he grew to hate me. because back then, Ted, the actual series of encyclopedias came out probably in more like 1959, 1960. But there was a series of encyclopedias called the Book of Knowledge. I don't know if you remember those. But anyway, we had a set of those. That was in my bedroom. That was only child. A lot of times I had nothing better to do than sit around and thumb through encyclopedias. I know that sounds really geeky and weird, but hey, that's what I had to do, right? There was an article, or there were entries in the encyclopedia around amateur radio. And there was actually a project in there that basically a detailed project, you know, how to build an amateur radio transmitter. And so, of course, once I discovered this in the encyclopedia, after having looked it up, after having met the guy across the street and seen that he has an amateur radio station that I was hearing on my crystal radio, I took the encyclopedia over there and I said, can you help me build this? And I'm pointing at this glossy, you know, book of knowledge encyclopedia page that has this detailed schematic and pictures of some, you know, tube transmitter and receiver that someone has built. Well, I'm only at the time in, I think I must have been in the third grade. And to me, I thought, well, this guy certainly fixes TVs. He ought to be able to help me build this thing, right? He didn't want any part of that. And so fast forward to probably 1968. My parents' hobby was antiquing. And so we spent most weekends out gathering up antique items that they would then bring home and refinish. And they had a stall, sounds kind of weird, but that's what I guess what they called them. There was a place in Kansas City, and it's actually still there today, Ted. It's called Things Unlimited. It's like an open market. And my parents had a stall there, quote unquote, where they sold their refinished antiques that was part of their hobby, something to do on weekends. And so I had to go there with them on weekends, and they did their antique thing. And I had nothing else to do but roam around the open market. I ran across a guy and his dad. I don't remember his last name, and I certainly don't remember his call sign. His name was Harold. And he probably, at the time, was probably maybe 17, 18 years old. And his dad, he and his dad had a radio electronics equipment kind of stand, you know, where they had all kinds of old radio parts and stuff that they sold. And so, of course, I was immediately fascinated by that. And I would stop by there, you know, every weekend, every Saturday, we'd go. Mom and Dad would do their thing. I would hurry up and go over there. I split my time between the guy that sold records, who was kind of skeevy and odd, and Harold, the radio guy. So I kind of leaned more towards Harold, the radio guy, and his equipment, and I kind of hung around there a lot. And he, you know, sort of talked to me about radio in general and things. You know, this is what I do. This is the hobby. This is why we're out here. This is what these parts do. You can do this, this, and this. And at one point, he talked to my dad, and they allowed me to go with Harold to his house, and he showed me his amateur radio station. And Ted, it was amazing. Harold and his dad in the basement had, I don't know how to describe it. At the time, of course, I'm 9 years old, and I'm in this basement looking at a console of equipment that's certainly taller than I am. What I do remember is that it was mostly Hammerlin equipment. He had all these Hammerlin transmitter, Hammerlin receiver. He may have had some other things, but at the moment I remember the Hammerlin because the name fascinated me. And Harold proceeded to demonstrate to me the fact that you could turn on the radio and you could immediately start talking to people. And I remember that he got me to talk to a couple of contacts, and I was hooked. That was it. Boom, done. I'm that's what I want to do, something I want to do. So we went back to the open market that afternoon, and, you know, of course, I informed my dad that this is probably what I need to do. So whatever it is that it takes to do this, I, you know, please comply. And lo and behold, the next Christmas, I got a Hammerlin HQ-170A for Christmas. It was a Red Cross cast off. Apparently, the Red Cross there in Kansas City was upgrading their station, and they were selling off their older equipment. And Harold hooked my dad up with this deal, and, you know, I got a Hammerlin HQ-170A. So that was my first ham radio piece of gear. And it was a receiver, of course, and the thought was that I would play with that for a while. I would learn how that worked, and that I would, you know, get the amateur radio study guide, and that I would start studying. And of course, I tried to do that. Got to imagine, you know, with parents who weren't really into radio, I didn't really have a lot of guidance there, so it was kind of all up to me. And so I did read the you know, I'd read through as much as I could understand of the study guides at the time. And I really wanted to do that. But there was a turn of events or turn of fate, I guess it was. And we moved away to pursue a business that my grandparents had outside of the country. And so we ended up somewhere where, as it turned out, you couldn't get an amateur license until you were age 18. So that kind of blew everything for me for several years. And so that stopped. And so we have to fast forward several years, many years, actually more than a decade, to 1995. And that's when I got my amateur radio license. And I got it purely at the time, to be honest, so that I could interact with the Oklahoma City National Weather Service office to do storm spotting. And that's where it all started for me, was amateur radio, as it were. Actually being licensed was there. And, you know, I started out doing it purely as part of my job, because in central Oklahoma at the time, you know, the local radio station was the information dissemination point for all things weather-related. And so when we would have bad weather, I would be sort of the liaison between the National Weather Service and our station, and broadcast whatever information they could give us from their storm analysis, and so that we could inform our public. And it just kind of grew from there.
Well, I was going to say, though, you know, you started talking about storm spotting, you know. So, I mean, now, how did you hear about that? How did you see that? Did you ever see it in action? What I want to say is what attracted you in there, and how much of that did you get to do, and, you know, how active were you in it?
Well, so the storm spotting sort of came about in the previously at the first station I worked at. So we were at that station, as I mentioned, we were out in, kind of far northwestern Oklahoma. And so we were the go-to place for weather information for people. And being literally in Tornado Alley, I mean, right in the middle of it, we had quite a few large storms move through there, you know, on a weekly basis during tornado season. We were the only local station. As a matter of fact, I think we were the only station between I don't want to say between Oklahoma City and Denver, but I can tell you that we were the only local radio station within over 150, 200 miles of our station that actually had its own weather radar. We had a Ellison 200 weather radar, color weather radar, which we promoted quite heavily on the air. As you can imagine, using the word color and weather and radar all together is very exciting on the radio. And so we used that. It's actually an aircraft radar that's built into a kind of a base unit. You put the radar antenna on the roof, and quite a thing. You can look it up on the internet. It's actually still out there. There's some diagrams, and I think actually the operator manual is out there for that thing. But so we had that. So I was very interested in weather, just the whole idea of the fact that we lived in a part of the country where pretty severe weather would move through. So I kind of carried that with me, and at my next job, we did a fair amount of weather reporting, because I had moved south and east of my previous location, and put me even more in the middle of quote unquote Tornado Alley. And so this station that I was at there in Chickasha, Oklahoma, was just right in the track of where things came up through Wichita Falls, Texas. Everything seemed to start in Wichita Falls and moved northeast from there. So we were right there. And so we did a lot of weather reporting. And at one point, we started actually, when I say we, myself and the news director, would take turns going out, and he and the station pickup, which was equipped with a MARTI transmitter, and myself in my car, which I had equipped with a Regency 4-channel VHF transceiver that had the MARTI frequencies on it. It was also one of their remote rigs. And we would go out and report on storms. And so when we would see something coming up, I don't know if you remember, if you probably weren't in Oklahoma at the time, probably not familiar with a product called RADAP, but it was something that the National Weather Service put out. It was a text-based, ASCII character-based radar representation that they would send out over the Oklahoma News Network on one of the subcarriers, and you could use a little FSK decoder, which they would provide to you. You had to do some soldering and mount it in something and put a connector on it and hook it up to some sort of a serial printer to get an output. But you got basically an ASCII representation of a not NEXRAD. NEXRAD wasn't around yet, but it was a sort of a storm level indicator kind of a map. And so we would look at that map and say, okay, we're going to go drive over here, and we're going to wait for the storm to hit us, and we're going to report back, and we're going to be all excited about it. And that's what we did. And so that was exciting in itself. I have tape somewhere of myself having run off of the end of the road at a T-intersection, right as the hailstorm, the hail core of a tornado was passing over my Ford Fiesta, and it was pretty loud. And I have that recording somewhere. I'm going to have to dig that up sometime and listen to it again. But that was all very exciting, doing the weather. And so at that point, being very interested in the weather and reporting the weather, when I found out that local repeater organization there in southwestern Oklahoma, SWIRA, S-W-I-R-A, was very closely affiliated with the National Weather Service in Oklahoma City, and that they exchanged reports, they exchanged spotter reports. They had a whole army of spotters that would go out and report back into the SWIRA network, which would then liaise directly with the National Weather Service. I thought, well, that's great, man. I can get these reports, and we can, inform our listeners all around the area what's going on. So got my ham life. I studied for, I had the question pool on a floppy disk, and I spent an hour a night for a week, literally for a week. I started Monday, stopped doing it Friday night. Saturday went and got my tech license, and I actually passed. They enticed me to go ahead and take the general, and I passed that, but I didn't have the CW portion yet. So I didn't get that, but I got my tech license, and that's kind of where I started out, Ted.
Well, you started out when CW was a requirement. Then you had to.
It was a requirement, yeah.
I remember taking the test in the Detroit Federal Building, and the ceilings in that place were really, really high. They had marble floors, marble walls, and glass. I don't think there was one piece of acoustical type absorption material. And they started that machine up in the front, and of course I was sitting all the way in the back, and all I could hear was all the dits and dahs were all one great big long tone with all that reverb in there. But I managed to pass it somehow. But now today I get these looks from people when I say the code is no longer a requirement, and their jaw goes down. They have this shocked look on their face. And I've been thinking, gosh, this has been a long time. It hasn't been a requirement. Where have they been, Where did you take your test? Did you have to go to a specific location? There probably wasn't volunteer examiners then.
Oh, there were. It was at a ham fest in Lawton, Oklahoma. And they had the VE testers there. And I think there were probably about... maybe 20 guys there, and so sat down, took the test, and passed it, and promptly, of course, that was, the internet was kind of around back then. We didn't get to go check the ULS and say, hey, am I on or am I not, what's going on? We had to wait, Finally get the notification.
I guess I must have taken my test back around 1812. So I don't know. There was no internet. Nobody even suspected anything like internet back then. Matter of fact, back then I don't even think there was any BBSs on computers. I don't even know if CompuServe was around back then. Boy, oh boy, I think about that. Anyhow, how did we survive without the internet? Sometimes, though, I just wish the thing would come apart, you know, and we'd have to go back to, you know, really communicating instead of all this. You're going down the freeway and these people got their cell phones up there just texting away, you know, weaving from lane to lane. You know, you get a group of people together and everybody's got their cell phones out. No one's talking, just on the cell phone. You ask them a question and they go, huh? What? Did you say something? What?
Oh, I would derive a certain amount of pleasure on being the only guy around that can actually send text messages without the internet.
It was a Chip because, Margelli, and who was it? Some other fella went on, all right, what was it? Jay Leno.
That was Leno.
On the Leno show, and they sent CW back and forth, and I guess there was some kids there texting, and the CW beat the text as far as speed was concerned. Beat it hands down. I was rather proud of that. I thought that was pretty cool. But, well, you know, okay, so now, all right, you're you know, you're a broadcast guy. Where do you hang out now? What do you do? What part of ham radio has got you captivated?
Well, I kind of, once I got my general license, I became, let me just digress a little bit. So after getting my tech license, of course, you know, tech license, you have all kinds of privileges. I think a lot of people don't really understand the amount of bandwidth they have access to with a technician license. It's phenomenal. You are basically, you know, everything from 6 meters to lasers. You know, I mean, you can, there's a lot there. So the thing that that interested me the most was 6 meters, and I put up my first 6 meter station with some gear that with some pretty antiquated gear. I had an SR-46 Hallicrafters and a Chris-Craft 5-element 6 meter Yagi that I put up, and I had this little 100-watt tube type amplifier. So because the SR-46 would only do 10 watts on AM, mind you, basically no sideband, it was AM. And so the SR-46 put out the 10 watts, and a little amp would boost it up to, I don't know, probably about 75 watts or so. And that was probably fortuitous. The time that I actually started experimenting with that was a time when the 6 meter band was actually kind of open, and so it was immediate gratification. I was able to talk AM, and mind you, that was in itself, the fact that I was able to use AM on there when I had been using, you know, FM on VHF and UHF. I was able to use AM on 6 meters, and it was just really cool, right, on a tube-type radio. Then I kind of got into satellites. I put up a pretty small. That was back when the Russian satellites were still up. The RS-11, 15 were still up, and you could hit them with, a relatively inexpensive setup. I had an 11-element dual polarity Chris-Craft Yagi for 2 meters, and I could receive back on the downlink on 10 meters on just a little vertical, and so that was interesting. Satellite communications, AMSAT or HAMSAT was really fascinating for me. Just the idea of, you know, waiting there with my computer program running to hear that signal as the satellite popped up over the horizon, and then, you know, trying to bounce some RF off of that thing and actually, you know, have someone respond was just fascinating. And you know, it's something you could do with a tech license. You didn't have to have a general license. You didn't have to have a big giant setup. You know, you basically could do that with a pretty small pretty small VHF transmitter, and not a huge antenna, and a, you know, some sort of a 10-meter receiver.
This guy's working satellite with these Beifung handhelds.
Oh yeah,
you know,
well, and people can do that now, and I don't know if people realize that, that you know what you can do with very, very simple amateur radio equipment these days.
A technician can do EME or moon bounce too if they want to
exactly
get the equipment and get the know-how. But the technician also has CW privileges down in certain portions of the bands, and I'm not up on that, but I that's what I have read and what I've been led to believe, and that is you can run CW on, I guess, 40 and 80, and I don't know where else, but the technician has that privilege.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say that I've seen a resurgence in interest in that amongst techs that I see discussing this on forums and on the local repeater nets and so on and so forth. But I think there is some interest more than there have maybe over the past decade or so to sort of explore those other privileges that they have that may have been sort of forgotten in the hurry to I'm going to get my tech license, I'm going to get my 2-meter 440 transceiver, and I'm going to get on the repeater. You know, that wears out. That fun wears out, I think, pretty quickly nowadays.
I've got to do a station identification. This is WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, United States of America. Well, let me ask you this question. What do you think about the, I want to call it, lack of activity on 2 meters? I hear this from everybody. Everybody says, I don't know. I can't seem to, I've been traveling across the country and I can get into I don't know how many different machines, but I just can't get anybody to answer me, And I said, well, what do you do? Well, I get on the CB radio. So what do you think about this? I've experienced it myself. And I've noticed that even here where I live in Lebanon, these machines are not active at all. And why do you think that is?
I think people are just, I don't want to be.
Go ahead.
I don't want to sound like sort of like some crusty old Luddite. But the thing is that it is very, it's a very valid observation that has been made that the internet is killing easy ham radio. It's sort of like now you kind of, this is my perception, right? I could be totally wrong, but as I see it, you really have to be interested in the concept of radio to get beyond the repeater sort of mentality.
But isn't that the object of getting a ham radio?
Exactly. Exactly. And so what happened was it, and I'm sorry, I'm a no-coder, all right? But I'm going to tell you, I was interested in a lot of other things besides that. It wasn't just me getting on and with my walkie-talkie and, talking over the repeater. I did a whole lot of other things. I'm not special. A lot of people did that. But there is a whole sort of segment of potential really, good hams that get stuck on the repeaters long enough to become disgusted with it. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Okay, and let me interject something here. I want to see how this strikes you. I think ham radio should be fun. It should be fun to operate. People should be fun to talk to. You know, one of the coolest things I do that I like doing is, when you first go on, you have basically 10 minutes before you must identify your station. Okay, so when you first come on with your first transmission, it used to be years ago that you had to come on with your call sign and then you had 10 minutes or whatever. But the way the rules read now, from what I understand, you got about 10 minutes before you must identify. And then, of course, you have another 10 minutes before you must identify again. So what I like to do is I like to jump in the middle of the conversation with a bunch of these curmudgeons that police the 2-meter band, You know, they have the electronic billy clubs and handcuffs and everything. They have flares in their trunk. They have orange jumpsuits that they put on, you know. And so I'm going to scare you. You're going to say, oh, I get off the air. This guy.
I've been talking about R&L Electronics for a good while, and you've heard me go on and on about Roger and the crew at R&L. When you call there, you get answers. They answer the phone. The people answering the phone are knowledgeable folks. They carry everything. They've got transceivers. They've got antennas. They've got microphones. They've got coax, linear amplifiers. They've got antenna tuners. I mean, they've got everything ham radio. They're outfitted for the radio amateur. What a place to go. You'll love dealing with them because they're great people. You'll get great service. Everything will be shipped out promptly. There's nothing worse dealing with somebody that doesn't take your order seriously and you don't know whether or not it's going to get there on time. Believe me, I've been there. I've been there ordering ham gear. That does not happen with R&L Electronics. Roger and his folks care about you and they care about the fraternity of ham radio. They want to keep you going. They want to keep it going. For the best price, the best possible price, and the best service and quality from individuals that know the amateur radio hobby and really care, remember the name R&L Electronics. Go up to the web, go to Google, and put in R&L Electronics. Contact them and go to their website, and you can't go wrong.
You know, there are very few hobbies that can stick around for a century. But amateur radio is one of the growing survivors, with about 3 million currently active hams worldwide. Most of us know about the public service aspect of our hobby and how we can help neighbors by providing emergency communications. It works when nothing else does. But there's more to it than that. Hams are part of a worldwide community that spread goodwill with some of the nicest, smartest, and most interesting people that you'll ever meet. Of course, you know, it's easy to interest people in ham radio, but then there's that pesky test. And for many, that's a big stop sign. Those technical questions might as well be a foreign language to a newcomer. And frankly, a lot of the teaching tools aren't very good. But now, thankfully, there's a game changer. It's called Ham Test Online. And it turns the gobbledygook into something that's pretty easy to understand. And that makes getting licensed really easy. And not only is it inexpensive, but it comes with a 100% money-back guarantee. You get your ticket, or you get your money back. And in a recent independent study of new hams, 97% gave Ham Test Online 5 stars. So, if you've been putting off getting your license, no problem. Maybe you're a technician wanting to upgrade to general or extra. No problem. Try it right now. The first 50 questions are free. Your success is guaranteed. Try it out right now. www.hamtestonline.com. That's www.hamtestonline.com. You'll be really glad you did.
Okay. Are you a whacker hater?
Yeah. So then I get on and I'll say, you know, I got a question. How hard is it to pass the test to get the license to talk on one of these things legally? They go absolutely ballistic. I mean, you know, it never dawns on them that I'm pulling their leg. You know, of course, I sign my call within the 10-minute allotment, you know. But the minute I say that, we have the 2-meter Gestapo. And, I mean, they've got the gas chambers turned on, and they're out looking for me, you know. This guy, whoa, who is this? This guy that's on here like this unholy person, you know. I have the biggest time doing that because I hate the 2-meter police. I think that the 2-meter band, which is basically, you know, we have more, there's probably more techs, obviously, up on 2 meters. And these are guys that are learning the hobby. This is where it ought to be fun. This is where people ought to be able to play practical jokes on each other and tell jokes and carry on and really make it a fun place to be where people are, you know, hey, it's the morning drive. I've got to turn on my 2-meter rig and talk to the gang on the way into work this morning, you know. That's the way it used to be. That's the way it ought to be today. But I've heard so much Gestapo on, and God forbid, get on a 440 machine in Nashville We've got one guy here, Adolf, whatever his name is, and I mean, he'll run blind kids off the river. Oh, the National Weather Service is listening, and it's not a cloud in the sky, and it's beautiful weather, 70 degrees outside, but the National Weather Service is waiting for an emergency, so get off of here. You know, it's enough of that stuff, I think, to where I think people are almost afraid to turn a two-meter radio on unless they get their head bit off. Now, that's my opinion, and that and about $10 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, okay?
No, I think you have a good point. I think a lot of people, as I was sort of intimating, so what you have is we have a whole new sort of generation of, God, I'm going to sound like my grandpa here. I call them the makers, you know, the little maker kids, right? These are the kids that are cutting their teeth on, Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and, you know, all this cool computer stuff that we didn't have, right? That stuff didn't even exist. It wasn't that it existed and you couldn't afford it. It just simply did not exist.
No one had thought of it yet.
No, but they have all of these things, and then they learn that, hey, this thing actually can interact with an RF emitter or receiver of some sort and perform some really cool operation. I can do something with this if I can just. So I'm going to get my license, and I'm going to learn how to integrate this RF circuitry into my other thing that I've made, and I'm going to make it do something really cool. And in the process of that, along the road, they go and buy a Baofeng, transceiver, and I get on there and they find out that, I love everybody, but probably 90% of the people that are on the repeaters have no idea what these guys are into. They have no idea what they might be experimenting with or how to even talk about it. And so what they immediately find is that there's no one like them on the repeater in the first place. So that sort of drops the interest level down somewhat. And then maybe they catch a couple of 2-meter nets, and that's it. They're done. You know, it's like, okay, I there's no one here that I can talk to. And I think we lose a lot of guys that way. And that's why I'm a big fan of sort of promoting amongst the maker crowd, if you will, the fact that amateur radio is there, and that if you have an amateur radio license, you are allowed to experiment with really high power things in the realm of spectrum that is applicable to the type of experimentation that they're wanting to do, which is everything from VHF on up. There's really nothing on HF that you can do with HF that you can interface with a Raspberry Pi or something like that to control something. Everything's going to be up in the gigahertz almost, right? It's going to be up at least in UHF. But you have full privileges up there with just the minimal license. So, but you have to have that in order to legally experiment with this stuff, over a certain power level. And so I try to promote that. It's like, go ahead and get your license. Maybe you don't have to talk. Don't talk. I don't want you to talk. But what I want you to do is take your license and use it. Do something cool with it. Connect it up to your breadboard computer, whatever. They're not even breadboard anymore. Everything's all, surface mount, and it's already kind of ready to go, and you just plug everything together.
However, I've seen a bunch of articles, and of course at Dayton, I stopped by and talked to some folks. There are people interfacing the Arduinos and the Raspberry Pis into all kinds of HF stuff that I was not even aware of. And
they're playing with signal processing,
And it's just really cool. The one fellow was showing a rig remote controlling a rig somehow, and it was over my head because I didn't study it, so to speak, and don't know anything about it. But I just thought, here's all these toys that they've got to play with now. They can program them to do all kinds of stuff, and have far more fun than we had, doing things that we couldn't do. And I think it's marvelous. But I think you're right. I think the first time they sit and they listen to a 2-meter net you know, two or three times, because we have chosen to conduct these things in such a way that if you had to choose between watching paint dry and participating in a 2-meter net, it'd be a tough choice. Okay, I mean, so I realize, but there's a human side here. See, this is the thing. I think sometimes I really believe that the amateur radio license ought to have a human element. Okay, a human element. One of the things that is part of the existence of amateur radio, and that is to enhance international goodwill. That's part of what the definition is as to why ham radio exists. You know, so when I say the human element, there should be a human element that kind of it's like this: a young person signs his call sign on a 2-meter machine. The immediate reaction, and I think it almost has to be taught, because it doesn't seem to come automatically, is for the individuals who are there listening, or someone who's busy in his room but he has the radio on, is to run over to the radio and grab the mic and say, "Hey, welcome to the repeater. I don't think I've ever heard you before. What's your call sign again? And where are you at? How long have you had your license? Well, boy, this is exciting. I'm glad to hear you on here. I look forward to talking to you again. I can't really talk right now. I'm right in the middle of something, but I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to say hello." Okay? Now, the reaction we get today, young person signs on a 2-meter machine, and some curmudgeon sitting across the room says, "I never heard him before. I wonder who the heck he is." And he's got maybe a young-sounding voice, so the curmudgeon says, "I hope I don't have to sit around and listen to that all day long." See, I mean, that's the difference. That's what I'm talking about. And I think the right attitudes almost have to be taught, because they obviously don't occur automatically, all right? But I think that's the key to the success at getting young people in and getting them to attend local clubs and getting them to upgrade. They've got to feel part of it. They've got to feel welcome. You know, and they can't be ostracized just because they're younger, or maybe they got a little squeaky voice like a 7 or 8-year-old. That very well could be. All the more reason to say, "Hey, I'm really glad to hear you on here," you know, and to encourage them along. Now, tell me where I'm crossways here. And feel free, take a shot.
No, I agree with you absolutely, because and so I can say that locally here in San Antonio, where I live, fortunately we do have a few young hams, what has happened there is these hams have been mentored. They're kids whose parents may not necessarily be involved in ham radio, but they have respected acquaintances or friends or teachers who are ham operators, who the parents feel safe and you know, allowing these people to mentor their kids in this hobby, right? Because it is an unusual hobby for most people. It's always been that way. That's just what it is. And so we do have a few kids, and I can say that I haven't heard someone not acknowledge a young ham here, and I've always heard them encourage the young hams, and I think that's a great thing. I can imagine that there are probably some other places where that, you know, it may not be like that. That maybe they might be maligned, or they might be teased or whatever, and that's not the right way to do it. But you know, I have to go back to, I mean, Ted, you have yourself, your own family. I mean, obviously you've raised some hams yourself. And so my wife and I, my XYL, and I had this discussion just minutes before I got the call from you guys while I was sitting there waiting. She said, I was explaining to her, I said, you know, here's Ted Randall, you know, and I'm just going to back up a little bit. I told her, I said, you know, he's like my new hero, because
oh boy,
I'm not being cheesy. It's the deal is that I told her, I said, he's kind of like my new hero, because he's on shortwave radio. and I can listen to him, and he's playing music I like, and he's doing things like he's on the air, he's being the boss jock guy, you know, and that's really cool to hear that on shortwave. I said, and he's also a ham operator, because, you know, she sort of has this, she listens to some of the repeater nets and some of the, you know, when it's like a contest weekend and I'm in there doing really short QSOs, like 5-9, thank you, right? And she's convinced that we're all kind of pretty boring, right? I said, no, this is a guy that's doing, you know, a radio show, but he's also a ham. And I said, look, he's got kids that he brought up. He says, well, how do kids get interested in that? I said, most of the kids that I know that whose parents are involved in ham radio become hams or get this interest early on in life, and they carry that with them and they stay with it. Whereas it's much more difficult for a kid whose parents are not interested in radio at all to even get exposed to it in the first place and then get some follow-up education or prompting or mentoring to sort of carry them, you know, forward. And it is tough.
I got my son David sitting here, and he can verify the fact that what I did is each week that they could not pass the technician test, of course they get their generals now, I made them eat a half a pound of raw liver. Okay,
this was every week. Let me tell you, you know, if we didn't study, we had to have like double portions of liver,
and it worked. I mean, it's oh,
but,
man.
But David, weren't you interested though? Weren't you fascinated though when Dad was sitting there at his console? Now, of course, him being in radio, it's almost magnified. My daughter went through the same thing, you know, sitting around having to hang out with Dad on the weekends at work, and I'm on the radio, and then I go home and I'm on the radio. It's like, Dad, you're always on the radio. You're either on the radio here or you're on the radio there. What's going on? But I think, I mean, wasn't it fascinating? I mean, if you were exposed to it at an early age, you kind of wanted to be in Dad's club. And I think that's what I was explaining to my wife. It's like a, If a child sees his father or his mother even doing ham radio from the get-go, from an early age, it's kind of like a club that they want to be in. They want to be doing something that mom and dad is doing, just like kids always want to do things that mom and dad do. And that's just another thing that it's a club that, unlike other clubs, I mean, Dad can be in Rotary, Dad could be a Shriner, Dad could be in Kiwanis Club, Dad could be whatever, and children aren't accepted into those clubs. But ham radio, children are accepted into. Kids can study, they can pass the test, and they're in the club. And they're in the same club that Dad's in, and I think that's a big thing.
What's the big ham fest that's located near you?
The biggest one is maybe Belton, I think. It's up north. We don't really have a big ham fest. There's one that's in Schertz. You know, it's a relatively small ham fest. It's an annual ham fest, but it gets pretty good attendance. But I guess the biggest close one would be something up in, you know, Belton, or maybe something in Houston.
Well, the reason I ask is I didn't know. Do you ever go to Dayton?
I don't. I haven't. A friend of mine who runs a satellite communications company in Colorado has been, and we've been friends for years, and he's a ham, and he's been threatening to kidnap me, force me to go to Dayton, because he goes every year, and he's always asking, you know, why don't you go to Dayton? I keep telling him, I don't need anything. I'm going to get up there. And he says, it's not about that. He says, it's just about the whole experience. And I don't know, maybe you can elaborate on that.
That is true. We go and we broadcast live on WTWW from the Dayton Hamvention. And first off, the people that run Dayton are phenomenal. How they pull it off, I really don't know. This place, I mean, it's huge. I mean, there's more people there than there are people. You look around and you think to yourself, you know, whoever organized this, you know, but I guess they've been doing it so long, you know, it's turned into a really well-oiled machine. The only problem that they have at Dayton is dealing with the Hera Arena, which is aging. It's an aging facility, and it presents its own problems. But the Dayton Hamvention, I guess I want to say, it just overshadows everything. So when you're inside the Hera Arena and you're out in the flea market area, you know, it totally dwarfs the venue. You don't even think about where you are. You just see the people. And if you can imagine, the flea market is like, what is it, David? How many football fields would you say that's equivalent to? I don't know. I mean, it's like you can't.
It's basically you have a, well, again, it's a giant arena. So, I mean, you know, they house, like a large basketball stadium. You know, so I mean, obviously, you have to have parking for all of those people.
But
so,
I'm talking about just the flea market area.
I know, but I mean, this is a giant, giant area, and then there's even more that's added to that. So I mean, it's just tons of square footage that's out there.
If you're actually looking at things, you couldn't possibly see the flea market in one day. If you're moving at a moderate pace and you really are looking at different things, I mean, you know, you actually see what's on the tables. You can't do it in a day. There's no way. You know, I just... And what's really strange is you'll find things out there that you never... I mean, you wouldn't even dream you'd find. I mean, you just have to see it. But I've been out there... I was out there 1 year. And a friend of mine from Detroit, I remember at the radio station that they... they worked at. They used a whole bunch of these Altec mixers, you know, for doing remotes, the green-faced Altecs with the meter on the right and whatnot.
Yep.
And I was walking around, and I looked, and I said, you know, that looks like an Altec mixer. So I walked over to the thing. I said, what do you want for that? He told me some price. And I got on the phone, and I said, hey, you know, I think I was talking to my friend Barb. I said, do you think your brother Chuck was the one that hired me, first radio job I ever had. You think Chuck would be interested in an old Altec mixer just to have, you know? So I wound up getting the thing, you know, and then lo and behold, while I was standing there, there was another Altec mixer, very similar to it. So I picked up the both of them. I still think I have one of them in the attic. I don't know, but the good one went to my friend Chuck. And I remember they had those things, I think, at every remote location. They used those Altec mixers. And who would dream you'd see something like that? A working one yet, you know? Man, I'm telling you, I recall seeing old gates, yard boards, Sparta boards, you name it, radio consoles out there in the middle of this flea market. AM transmitters. There was a guy I had on the back end of a pickup truck, oh, I don't know, one or two Daytons ago, had an old Collins 20V. you know, another one had a Gates transmitter of some sort, I don't know, 400 A's, or an RCA with 833s in it. You know, I mean, it's just, where do you see things like that? No place. The only place you can see that is at Dayton, you know. And it's kind of mind-boggling. You walk through and somebody said that Dayton was where hams go to revisit their old equipment, you know, and I believe that, because if you see one, you'll see 10 HT-37s out there and SX-101s and Hammerland HQ-170s and 180s and all that. So if you have a weak spot for that kind of thing, it's fun to visit, you know. Not fun to be broke when you go there, I can tell you that, and you may be broke when you leave. But Dayton, there's only one Dayton, and if you ever have the opportunity to go, I would highly recommend going to the Dayton Hamvention.
It sounds like a lot of fun, and, you know, you mentioned all the you know, boat anchors, quote-unquote. I really fear for the older technology like that, you know, what's going to happen to it in the next 10, 20 years? You know, who's going to curate it? Who's going to take care of it or actually keep it on the air? You know, I don't know if you do any AM, but there are quite a few very impressive stations out there on 15 meter AM, which I like to kind of hang around the, at 21-430, kind of the AM watering hole on 15 meters, and just listen to some of the stuff the guys are running there. It's absolutely amazing sometimes what you hear pop up on there. It's not that it rivals broadcast stations. It's better than broadcast stations. It actually is, as far as just voice, phone, you know, voice only transmissions, these guys really have this down to a science. And it's just, it's amazing what they're doing with some of the gear that they've put back together, you know, stripped down, cleaned, put back together, souped it up. And, you know, they got it running there in the shack, and I don't want to know what their electrical bill is. And but it sounds good, and that's what counts. And I just hope that sort of continues, you know, for a while longer. You know, nowadays, the SDR gear that's out there, stick it on AM, some of that stuff sounds just fantastic, you know, and it's something that's, you know, the size of a power switch or something, you know. It just I have an old Flex 3000. It's old now, Ted. But it's the Flex 3000 been out of production for a couple, 2-3 years now. It's an antique in the world of that. But the thing about it is, you can plug directly into it. You can do direct. It's unbalanced audio, but you can do a balanced unbalanced converter into it, and drive that thing up to, you know, 4 kilohertz, and it really sounds good. And, you know, people, I think there's a lot of experimenters out there still that like to play with high quality audio, and maybe they do it on the ham bands, and, you know, of course that irritates a lot of people. It's like, oh, you're taking up all this bandwidth. But I don't know about you, Ted, but if you've listened on a non-contest day, there's plenty of space up there to experiment.
I don't know. I don't have much patience for the folks that say that AM takes up too much bandwidth and all that. You know, I really enjoy tuning in and listening to these guys running plate modulated rigs, and some of them running PDM modulation, homebrew. I find the AM window, the people that are in the AM window talking, the ones I listen to mostly is on 80 meters or on 40. I find their skill set is far, far above the round table single sideband guy that just hangs out on 80 meters. You listen to them, and these guys, they know what they're talking about, and they have interesting things to say, and you can learn listening from them as they're talking about a subject of some sort. If you're willing to listen, they're actually teaching. But I think that... that's kind of a lost art, too. It's just easier to get into a round table and talk about, you know, politics and, you know, get a heated discussion going on the election. You know, that's an easy road to go down, you know. But these guys get on and talk, and they don't just talk about AM. They talk about all kind of other things, antennas. They talk about just about anything ham radio. And
no, and they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and I get a bang out of listening to them. I tuned in one night, and there was a fellow on that had just built a homebrew PDM transmitter. And boy, did that thing sound sweet. I mean, it really, really sounded good. And the other thing, too, AM is really, if the signal is strong enough, it's really easy on the ears. It's not like single sideband. Single sideband, even with the best audio, of course, you know, I'm more attracted, and I guess maybe I got a screw loose somewhere, but I'm more attracted to communications audio. I like it when it's crisp and clean and punchy and loud, okay, because I want to hear it. I don't want to have to strain. And so many times I hear these guys on sideband, they're running some sort of a dynamic microphone, and they've got it EQ'd a certain way. They're trying to sound like an AM broadcast station, And I don't know if any of them even know what an AM broadcast station sounds like today. By the time you get done adding an Omni, a 9 or an 11 or some other audio processor on an AM broadcast station, those things are compressed and really, I mean, aggressive sounding. But I remember there used to be a time, even going back to the days of Citizens Band Radio, where these guys would use a D-104, and some sort of a compressor amplifier and connect that into the rig, and it would increase the intelligibility, and you could hear the person a good distance further than you could with the stock microphone on the radio. And I remember in the AM days, back before, well, sideband was just coming on the scene, there was a lot of guys that was using the Waters compreamp and the Waters compressor, compreamp, the clipreamp. The clipreamp and the compreamp, and I don't know, there was a bunch of those things. And they all added. But it was not hi-fi, it was communications audio. But it punched through, and it was easy to listen to. That, I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but you know, you may be a hi-fi guy. So
I'm not an ESSB guy, and I'll tell everybody that I'm not, and I love all these guys. I know some of them locally, and I listen to what they're doing. And you know, I got to say, they take their sideband rig and they spread it out, and it sounds pretty good. I mean, they spend a lot of time adjusting and tweaking, and I think it's like people that have tuner cars, right? You tweak and you adjust and you see what it sounds like, and you do this and you do that, but it's still sideband, right? There's nothing like AM. You know, you're talking about old processors or compressor limiters. My favorite setup on my old 6-meter SR46 was I had a Daiwa RF440 speech processor in front of it, and with a D104. And man, that thing, I got the best, you know, unsolicited. We always say that I had unsolicited audio reports and good audio reports, excellent audio reports, 5.9, and I'm only running 10 watts. And but that's fun, you know. It's on my station. Well, up until recently, on AM, I would. Do you remember the old Inovonics gear?
Oh yeah.
So I had an Inovonics Map 2. The AM version, not the chained FM one, but the actual AM one, that I ran on AM, and I had it hooked up in a processing chain. It was, you know, an Aphex oral exciter and all that kind of stuff, and Valley Audio mic processor and all that. But I didn't tweak it to sound. I wasn't interested in it sounding particularly hi-fi. It's more, the thing about the old Inovonics Map 2s was, at the time when they came out in the early 80s, that was the most aggressive sounding AM audio processor out there, maybe besides the DAP.
How many bands?
Three-band.
How many bands did that thing have on it?
The Inovonics, the Map 2 has 8 bands, and it's compressor limiter on each band.
I remember that. I think I've got one of those somewhere here. I've also got a DAP, a couple of DAPs here too. But you know, the DAPs weren't real aggressive. They were I guess I want to say they were a little bit on the passive side, I thought, you know. And then they just didn't have that bang to them that the Map 2 had. The Map 2 was aggressive. You could adjust that thing to where it would really just fatigue the daylights out of your ears if you wanted to.
Yeah, 125% forward, and it could be nasty, but anyway, it sounded good on the ham bands, and so I used that for a while, and but you know, it's all good, and that's the great thing about ham radio is today there are so many things that you can do on ham radio. You know, we were talking about using the little Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and so on and so forth, try to interface them with ham radio. You know, a lot of guys are experimenting around now. We're just getting to the point where the DSP capabilities of these little board computers is just at the point now where it's able to be used to do digital modes on ham radio. So that makes it so that we're almost at the point where you can have a little black box, basically, that does your whole digital mode processing, whether you want to do JT65 or you want to do PSK or you want to do RIDI, you want to do, you know, Olivia, Contestia, whatever mode you want to do. These boards are all, they're not quite, but they're almost at the point where they can do it. And so that's a really kind of an exciting thing, because what it leads us into is a whole other realm. This is my personal ambition, is to get to the point where we can have a digital HF mode that's not requiring a whole computer or, you know, four rack units of equipment to create a digital HF phone signal, along the lines of not DRM, but, some sort of digital mode. Because I don't know if you played with DRM very much or listened to it ever, but it's kind of fascinating that we can put out a completely quiet digital signal on HF that sounds almost as good as a hybrid, HD AM signal that you might hear on a broadcast band.
I've had a chance to listen to DRM just a little bit, and what little bit I heard, I was extremely impressed. We are fortunate enough to have a very, very good friend by the name of John Stanley. I can't remember what his call sign is. He was a guest here on QSO, but he worked as a missionary shortwave engineer for HCJB and also Trans World Radio, and he was a pioneer in the development of DRM. Actually, everybody says he wrote the book on it, and he lives not too far from us here in Chattanooga, and I don't know what the future holds, but I certainly would love to do some DRM programming on WTWW. I think that I think there's a future in it, and I think you could originate programming and find sponsors, and I think it would have a lot of interest. I think I've been really, really disappointed in IBOC, the in band digital for FM. They came across and started calling it HD radio, but really, when you get right down to it, it's digital radio, but it's low definition, if anything, because by the time the stations get done adding four individual stations on one frequency, the bit rate is so low it sounds like a bad MP3. So I don't know where they came up with this calling it HD radio. It's digital, but it's not high definition. It's not like television. So I don't know. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere too fast, other than the fact that people like to get an HD channel so they can get an FM translator for it, I think that probably has sold more HD transmitters than anything, but I don't think we got very many HD listeners out there. But I think DRM, on the other hand, on shortwave, has got some real possibilities. And so what do you think of it? Do you see any weaknesses in it?
I don't. Continental makes DRM transmitters, and guess where they're not selling them? The U.S. They're selling them to India and China right now, who are creating a huge broadcast platform or network based on DRM. And the fact that with DRM you can not only provide really high quality audio programming, you can also send digital data, digital text data and HTML over the, they're not even subchannels, it's just part of the encoding scheme. And so you can not only send voice, but you can send text data that people can store and save or store and forward or use for educational purposes, refer back to later. You could have a program on whatever topic you want, and you could provide literature along with it at the same time, and then someone could go back after the fact and read about the whole program, or read material related to that program that got transmitted into their radio right along with the voice in the background. And that, to me, that's fascinating. It's like the full Monty, right? You got the voice, you got the immediacy of the voice broadcast, but you also have something that you can go back to later and look at. And it's not a recording. You don't have to listen to the guy talking again. You can go back and read about it because it was broadcast right along with everything else. And so for those areas that don't have internet, of which there are plenty still, today, we're lucky in the United States, in the Western world, really, that we have, access to the internet like we do. and we can pull up pretty much anything we want at any time, assuming that all the infrastructure is functioning properly at any given moment. But, you know, the fact is that when you get into to those other countries, Africa and India, most of Asia, the infrastructure is just not there for the internet yet. So the availability of high quality voice and the ability to send data over HF is it's a great thing, and they're actually doing something with it.
And, well, you know, a lot of folks seem to think, for some reason, and I don't know why, they tend to think and they tend to believe that the internet is just everywhere, you know. And it's kind of interesting as you travel across the country, you know, you're going to go to places where you can't get internet. It's just not there in the U.S. You know, I mean. People are depending on internet from their cell phone. Well, that doesn't work. They have a little wireless hotspot thing, you know, and there's no internet on that, you know. So then you pull off the road and you go to a local hotel and say, "Do you have Wi-Fi?" And they go, "Well, no, it just don't do good around here in this place, you know." So you're stuck, you know. But people believe it's everywhere. It's like Chicken Man, you know. He's everywhere. But it's not. And so that, I think, that's one of the real strongholds for shortwave. And I know we've had a lot of folks that are listening to Midnight in the Desert with Heather Way, the Art Bell Show, and that they don't have any local affiliates in their area. And for some reason, they don't have internet access for a notebook computer or a cell phone. And so they pick up those Sea Crane Skywave radios like crazy because we come in good almost everywhere, and they can keep up and listen to that show. Of course, they're same people are listening to Dave Ramsey in the afternoon on WTWW. So we kind of, you know, once again, the internet's nice, but internet doesn't go everywhere. And it's not as convenient either. I think, you know, who wants to be toting a notebook around every time you want to listen to something? And if your cell phone... depending on your data plan, I mean, you can rack up some bills on a cell phone listening to stuff over the internet unless you're near a Wi-Fi connection. And a lot of people turn to the cell phone because they're not near a Wi-Fi connection. I don't know. It's, you know, but the shortwave, you know, get one of those little Skywave receivers, that thing slips right in your pocket and runs on a couple of AA batteries as long as you're not inside of a lead room. It does pretty fair picking this station up. But you know what? We're just about out of time here. So I'm going to ask you to kind of wind up with some final comments, maybe some things you want to say or something you'd like to express about ham radio that you'd like to kind of share with folks. And go right ahead, because I think we're looking at about 2 or 3 minutes here.
Well, okay. So all I could say about ham radio is that if there's anyone listening who has contemplated getting a ham license for whatever reason, and it's you're sort of waffling over it, just do it. Just go ahead and do it. Get your license. After you get your license, you have 10 years to decide what you want to do with it, okay? And we'll see you on the repeater, or we'll see you on HF, or we'll because inevitably most people who get their license end up on the air, and I think probably most of them end up staying on the air. And as far as radio goes, as I mentioned, I really enjoy your show. And you mentioned your friend with HCJB. That's the one that I contacted you on. That was one of the best shows ever. I was riveted. I sat there and with my headphones on, and I listened to the entire cast, and I thought, man, that was great to hear just. You know, the whole interview and all the background of HCJB and stuff. And that's what, I guess those are the things that you don't hear generally on quote unquote regular radio or, your broadcast radio. But you're going to hear it here on, WTLWW or another shortwave station. I just hope that you guys continue to do what you're doing. You're doing a great job. And I am, I guess I'm just an avid listener.
Well, we appreciate you listening, and it's always good to talk to another ham buddy, especially one that's been in the broadcast business on air and doing engineering, too. So you hit all the nails, you know, right on the head there. So, but I appreciate you coming on. I really do. And joining us, you have to come back, and then maybe you can give us an update on what's going on and what you're doing in the field of ham radio, as well as if you are, I guess I want to say, participating in the broadcast arena at some point in time. So I just want to say 73s, thanks a bunch, and hope to have you back on again very soon.
Thanks, Ted.
It might rain tomorrow, then I get some before I die. The rhubarb pie, the rhubarb pie. It might rain tomorrow, then I get some before I die. Save your lemons, get them up in the tree. Save your peaches, really don't get to me. Talk about something sure gonna make me shout. Go on, get some rhubarb pie. That's what it's all about. Rhubarb pie. Rhubarb pie. It might rain tomorrow, better get some before I die. Hey, little mama, can I walk with you? Got a hole in my pocket, another one in my shoe. Pies in the kitchen, setting out the windowsill. Talk about make my eyes bug out, Lord, it surely will. Rhubarb pie, rhubarb pie. In my rain tomorrow, better get some before I die. Oh, Lord. This rhubarb show is good. Rhubarb pie. Rhubarb pie. It might rain tomorrow, better get some before it dies. Rhubarb pie. Rhubarb pie. It might rain tomorrow, better get some before it dies.
Baby, love will always be young and free and naturally the way it's gotta be. Baby, baby, falling in love, I'm falling in love again. Baby, baby, falling in love, I'm falling in love again.
Broadcasting from near the banks of the Upper Cumberland River, this is WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, USA.
Sugarloaf and Green-Eyed Lady on WTWW. Ted Randall. with you. Got a little Rare Earth coming your way, but before we play Rare Earth, let me give you our email address. And that's so simple, it's just email at WTWW.US.
Never mind a girl.
Get ready on WTWW. Ted Randall with you, ladies and gentlemen. Ann Murray.
We'll be shadows in the moonlight. Darling, I'll meet you at midnight. Hand in hand we'll go, dancing through the Milky Way. And we'll find a little hideaway where we can love the whole night away. We'll be shadows in the moonlight, right up till the light of day. Ooh, the night is young, and baby, so are we. Glad, I'm gonna make you glad you came. Shadows in the moon.